You are listening to Studying Pixels, a podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan Heinrich Simond. I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan Hughes, a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. A new player joins the game. We've actually got someone new on the team, and we announced it on social media already. That would be Richard Mertens. If you have heard the name before, then that is because we thanked him several times on the show already, because he's been editing our episodes.
And doing a bang-up job, I must say.
Fantastic.
You may also, for the record, that name may be familiar to you if you're familiar with the podcast The Pike Horror Show, which is his own podcast endeavor.
Yes, he has his own show, The Pike Horror Show. We can put that in the show notes in case you want to check it out. It might also be that sometime soon we've got something on Studying Pixels involving Richard a little bit more. But for the time being, we invited him on our episode today in order to talk about Lovecraft and cosmic horror. We're going to have a whole lot to say about our passion for Lovecraft, about our problems with Lovecraft, and of course, about Bloodborne. What else?
It all goes back to Bloodborne, Stefan.
But before we go into that, let me briefly remind you that if you like this show, there is a way that you can help us make it happen. Because at the end of the day, we need to keep the lights on. And if you want to help us in doing that, then you can join Studying Pixels Plus. There, you will get all of our episodes entirely ad-free. You'll get a lovely sticker and monthly plus episodes. Sometimes they are deep dives into video game culture. Other times, they actually help you study. If you're curious about that, then you can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Richard.
Hello, Stefan. Hello, Dan.
Hey. Well, we're finally doing it. So you've been... you're here. We're going to talk about our favorite weirdo, H.P. Lovecraft.
Well, I thought you were going to talk about me. I got a little worried there for a second.
Our favorite weirdo.
I was flattered, but then offended in the same breath.
Lovecraft and Lovecraftian aesthetics is something that's been on our mind for quite a while now. We addressed the subject fleetingly on several episodes because it's just part of some of our favorite games. But before we get into that, we first obviously need to know, Richard, what got you into Lovecraft.
Yeah, it's not a terribly glamorous story. It didn't deep dive in the history of literature or anything. I did love Bloodborne, though, and Bloodborne was the only reason I bought a PlayStation 4. I knew I'd like it because it was a FromSoft game. And then I was like, who are all these tentacle folk around? I must know more. And it was like Lovecraftian, and then the imagery was so obvious when I looked a little more into it. And I, of course, being just like some punk, I got like a huge collection that you have such high hopes for when you buy a book. You have such high hopes that you're going to read it consistently or at all. But like I read through like the first few pages and I was like, this is old. So I put it on the shelf until I was a little bit older, and then in the past few years, I've gotten back into it and sort of understood I guess past just the aesthetics that are borrowed a lot. And now I'm still relatively new is my point. I didn't want to, I'm not an expert by any caliber.
Oh, but I think it's a fairly common experience, right? That you basically go down this rabbit hole of figuring out where inspirations come from, and then you go to the source material and immediately bounce off of it because you realize, wow, this is a completely different thing, right? Like, I get how Bloodborne lends aesthetics from Lovecraft, but it's clearly not the same thing.
Sure.
You're right. I think one thing to note about H.P. Lovecraft, so he wrote in the early 1900s, and he spoke like someone from the early 1900s. So for good and for ill, I should say, he was not a very nice man. We should get that out of the gate right now.
Sure, that is for sure an important thing to touch on.
He was a bit of a racist, to put it lightly. But yeah, I had the same experience, Richard, where it wasn't Bloodborne. I got into it a little bit before Bloodborne, but I definitely had to take my time with his writing because it's a little off-putting the first time you experience it.
Yeah, he definitely does not necessarily make it easy or very accessible to get into the stuff.
Mm.
I guess there is also a kind of just, you could say, maybe writing style of the time that lends itself to being deliberately eloquent, especially because often the perspectives, the narrative's perspectives that Lovecraft employed were then authors themselves or scholars or people who explored scholarly writing, right? He was almost obsessed with the advances of science, you know, the grasp of scientific development.
And I think that's such a good observation. Just touching on writing style a little bit, the way a lot of his writings are from a first person's perspective, or they're from a journal or an article, or some of them are as simple as, hey, I'm your friend and I'm going to tell you this story. And I think that is so immersive. Like, that's why I think the audiobooks are really effective, because it's a person telling you this story. But when you read them, sometimes it's just a wall of text that you have to kind of make your way through and break down piece by piece. And it's not something I do typically for fun. So knowing that the promise of like a big scary monster may be in the mix somewhere, it does keep me going as I make it through.
He does play around with that a lot. I recently reread Call of Cthulhu, the short story. And while it's definitely not my favorite short story of his, but it did strike me that when the entire thing is told by like someone who basically reads through reports and assembles this kind of mythological story, and at the end of this report stands this phrase of like, I hope that nobody shall read this report because it's far too dangerous and now I know too much. And it obviously in this, it's kind of like it has a metaleptical quality to it, as if it almost points to you as a reader and says, well, you have just read that story. You know, you just have read that account. Now you know too much as well. It's very eerie.
Absolutely. And I think I want to say it's my favorite, but I might be getting ahead of myself. At the Mountains of Madness has this setup of, here's the report that I'm going to release to the world. Here's what actually happened. So it breaks it up into those two little parts. And there is something super off-putting of someone saying, I know you won't believe this, but if I don't say this, it'll never be written down. No one will ever know what happened. This is the story you'll hear in the news and through people, but this is like the reality of what happened. And I just thought that was such an awesome storytelling mechanic that you couldn't use in any other medium, really. I don't think, not as efficiently, at least.
I agree. I think one of the cool things about what you've both just brought up is that, yeah, there's this distancing that all of the narrators give, but it's also a distancing out of desperation. Like, I need to impart this information to somebody. And I know that by doing so, I'm going to be damning you to the same fate as me, but it's like this infection where I have to get it out. And I think, like, obviously, when you go into something like that and you look at a game like Bloodborne, which is all about the infectious nature of knowledge and trying to understand that which we shouldn't. You look at Bloodborne and you think, of course that's a Lovecraft game. It has no choice but to be a Lovecraftian game.
Yeah, knowledge is such a crucial topic, because at the time when Lovecraft was writing, it seems, or I would describe it as a time where knowledge expanded radically, where the natural sciences made tremendous progress, where the early stages of psychoanalysis developed, kind of understanding a little bit more about how the mind works. And that kind of expanse of knowledge, it demystified a lot of things about the world. We learned to explain a lot of things in a rational manner. And at the same time, by doing so, we discovered something that is very striking, and that is how little we actually know. So we realize that there's still so many things. Like, you know, when you discover as a human species that there's, you make this new discovery. Wow, the universe is out there. There's a universe. There are other planets. And while you have learned something new, you at the same time are like struck by this overwhelming realization. We've seen nothing of these planets. We've seen nothing of the universe yet. And I think that's kind of like a crucial experience that kind of pervades a lot of Lovecraftian writing.
And I think that's a terrific point. The way you said, like, it's demystifying. So of course, if your world is slowly losing its luster and its mystery, where do you go? You go, like you said, beyond the stars. You pull from the deep reaches of space, and then you start reaching into different realities, different dimensions, and sort of going from each one, I guess, freely and connecting them, but separating them. And so it's not just, I saw a ghost, you know, it's much more complicated. You know, you're in a dream of a squid, and then the squid has friends. I'm clearly oversimplifying it, but just the
not
idea
by
that
much,
you,
though.
And I wish by more actually, but just the reaching to try and find something that's still new and scary when everything that you thought was scary is slowly being, you know, picked apart by numbers and studies and new finds.
Yeah, it struck me when yesterday I reread probably my favorite short story by Lovecraft, which would be The Color Out of Space.
It's a great one.
It's basically about this meteorite that strikes in a farmland. And there are scholars obviously approaching, tearing this meteorite apart and discover some strange kind of color substance. And then over time, this color substance, it leaks into the well and it takes over the entire land and it kills people. It's like pretty terrible. It's like a tremendous, like it constantly escalates. That's what I love about this story. It like keeps escalating and you know it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And the original point of that was not only the meteorite dropping onto this farmland, but also, most importantly, the scientists clobbering away at it, opening it up basically, making it into this dangerous object. So this strive for knowledge is inherently something that's threatening to ourselves.
One of my favorite lines from Bloodborne is when you fight Maria in the Old Hunters DLC, she's just sitting on a chair and she looks like a corpse. And when you approach her, she grabs your hand and says, a corpse should be left well enough alone. You know, like how dare you even attempt to learn more about something that should be uncracked, like the meteor that had the color out of space from it. It's this thing that he gets at where not only are there things that we don't understand, but that's not the horrifying stuff. It's scary, but the horrifying stuff is the inner drive to figure it out and want to know more. And the fact that we'll never get there is the true horror of Lovecraft, I think.
And just like expecting that everything in the universe has to abide by the same rules that people do. Because, you know, we begin and we end. So we think to ourselves that everything must begin and end. We kind of project that ideology upon everything in our surroundings, even though it doesn't really owe us that courtesy, which might be a bit of a side tangent, but The Color Out of Space, just kind of looping a little bit back, that is two of like my favorite Lovecraft elements, or at least two of the ones that I always like consider very Lovecraftian. The fact that I believe that's a letter written by someone who talked to a neighbor of the family. I believe that's how it's structured. It's like a reporter or something like that. And I just think that was such an interesting way to do that. And also being like, color came out of the rock. I can't describe it anyway. And then just like moving on, being like, oh, it's something I couldn't even tell you about. And then just sort of like,
yeah, it's always this element of something that cannot be grasped, that cannot be described, that cannot be rationalized, that cannot be explained. Bloodborne, the game we keep referencing, is such a perfect example because it does that with the mechanic of insight, right? It's called insight, right? Where you gather these insight points, and then over time, you start like seeing these weird creatures, these, I guess you could only...
The amygdala.
Amygdala, yes. Oh, beautiful name, the amygdala, which isn't that also a reference to a part of the brain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's near the brainstem or something. It's a very important part of the brain.
They are basically like the old ones, you could say, in Bloodborne. And I think that's so interesting that this, the more knowledge you gain, the higher this insight value rises, the more you can look into this abyss of, well, let's just say madness, for lack of a better word, but also the more you lose touch with rationality and the more you are susceptible, I think, to this frenzy status that can be inflicted upon you. It's such a beautifully intricate mechanic that, I think this is delicious, actually, that a gameplay mechanic, like a rule system that is programmed with numbers and that you can interact with, attempts to capture the feeling, the sensation that you might have while reading a story by Lovecraft.
One of the final stages of Bloodborne is the Nightmare of Mensis, where you're kind of going to the apex of whatever is happening in Bloodborne. You still can't really wrap your head around it. And by virtue of having played the game all the way to that point, you probably have amassed a lot of insight points, like you were talking about, Stefan. And so that area is filled with enemies that give you the frenzy status. And the more insight that you have, the easier you're going to die there by losing your mind. So it's actually a better idea to relinquish all of your insight, let go of your knowledge, so that you can have an easier time getting through this crazy nightmare that you're supposed to go through.
I am so mad. I never knew that mechanic. And now every time I play that area, I get absolutely demolished. And I always think, this game is stupid. That's when I'm done. So I'm always like, I hate this game now.
Hidden mechanics.
It does make a lot of sense. Another like very cool mechanic I like in Bloodborne that is related to the insight is it'll sort of set up these stages. In addition to like the combat and like the exploration, there is a door they have to learn the password for. Mm. And then there's a guy behind the door who's like, you never know the password. I don't know. And then he says, you need the password. And you beat a boss, you get the password, you go talk to him. And he's like, okay, welcome, come on in. And the door's open and he's a skeleton. So he was never there. And then you walk in the door, you get an insight. So I thought that was so interesting that you get it through like items and fighting bosses, but also through the world, they'll show you these scenes that are like, you're getting this insight. You're going a little more mad in this, from just this experience.
You're having encounters with something that you can't rationalize. And then the insight point that pops up is what gives you this indication of like, hey, something really strange just happened to you.
And I just think that it's such a small touch too, because it's just like a glimmer. And then like it goes up one and you just kind of like, you're like, oh, like you just, it's kind of like a double hit, or you see it and then you get that point. And like
something spooky happened.
Yeah, you get that sort of verification, like, this is weird. Oh, yep, this is weird. All right, gotcha. I got a point for it.
Okay, I think we are already in the middle of a subject that we have not yet called out by name, and that is the sanity meter. Maybe we can go into that a little bit more, but before that, we'll take a very short break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
And we are back talking about Lovecraft and cosmic horror with Richard Mertens. We just were getting into the subject of the sanity meter. And the sanity meter actually originated from Lovecraft, I would say, right? Because it's been, as far as I could find, the first time the sanity meter has been employed in a game, it was a board game of Call of Cthulhu, which was released in 1981. And people are still playing this game as well. And this had already introduced this kind of sanity mechanic. And then later on, it was adopted in other video games. Even nowadays, there's a Call of Cthulhu game. I think it was released in 2018, which uses the sanity meter. There's like, I think, The Sinking City, which is very much Lovecraft inspired, that has a sanity meter. Amnesia, most famously, I think.
Yes.
Also a sanity meter. So really, Lovecraft is kind of the source material for the sanity meter for good reason, because what else is the sanity meter than an attempt to rationalize madness? You take the scale of madness and you put it in numbers in a seemingly rational equation. I find that super interesting. Sure.
And it's also the idea of like a measurable amount, kind of like you just said. I'm basically just taking what you said and rewording it a little bit, but like, this is how much you can take. Like, these are the numbers. This is the value. After this, you can't handle it anymore, and you need to do something so it doesn't build up. And all those games you mentioned absolutely use it. There's also another board game called Arkham Horror that I believe has a mechanic very similar to that. It's always a little daunting to see it, right? So you play a game for the first time, you see your health bar, see your stamina most likely, and then it's like, your insane meter.
Okay, I know where this is going to go.
Like, yeah, I got to keep track of this now. Great.
I think what's so interesting too is that a lot of the games that use the sanity meter as the core mechanic usually don't give you a weapon or any way to defend yourself. It's usually just running away from things or hiding. Like, Stefan, you mentioned Call of Cthulhu, which I actually played within the last year. And that game definitely got that part of it right. And I think it took a lot of cues from Amnesia, The Dark Descent, which is where that mechanic really shines. Because you want to talk about all the things we've mentioned with Lovecraft. You play as Daniel, which is spooky for me, in Amnesia, The Dark Descent. And you're a scholar. You're trying to learn about what's happening in this castle and with this weird guy. And you're not trained. You don't have any, you know, weapon skills or anything. You're just running away from these things that you can't understand and slowly losing your mind, becoming more erratic as you do. So I would actually argue that Lovecraft translates better into video games for reasons like the sanity meter than it does onto the silver screen for movies. There's something about that interactivity that just, maybe because of the way that we discuss like the metaleptic way that these stories are often told, where it's from someone's perspective or someone else's perspective to you as a character. But I just think it just works better in video games.
Yeah, when you mention perspective, even in the context of Amnesia, it's not just that you can't defend yourself. It is the fact that if you see the monster, if you look at the monster, that is the time when you lose sanity already, right? So you have this kind of weird double bind that you are in because you're interactively involved, that of course you want to see the monster. Of course there's something moving in a dark corner. You're going to turn the camera towards it, right? But that is the worst thing you can do, because then you see it and your character is struck by horror, you lose sanity points, and in the worst case scenario, you have this like small mental breakdown, you could say, which incapacitates you for a couple of seconds. So I think that's what makes this interactive engagement with sanity and with the basically the fringes of rationality is what makes it so adaptable for video games.
I like to kind of bring it back to Bloodborne. There's, when you have the interactivity, the real terror can come in when that interactivity is taken away from you in one way or another. So there's a game for the GameCube, Eternal Darkness. And there's a moment in that where your character avatar just kills himself and you have no control over it. And it's very much in line with this kind of Lovecraftian horror of this thing that you think you know being taken away from you. And I'm thinking of, we mentioned the amygdala. There's that, how do you get to the DLC in Bloodborne? You let it take you and it grabs you and just takes you into this new place. And it's like you rest your control to try to learn more, but in doing so, you open yourself up to all these other horrible things.
And listen, I'm going to talk about Bloodborne and give it some criticism, but just know Bloodborne is my favorite game of all time. So this is not me being hypercritical or anything. But I think Bloodborne does have a tendency, especially in like earlier playthroughs, when you're playing like once or your first or second time, where it loses a bit of the wonder and like the immersion and the madness when you keep dying and keep losing and having to reset. Because I think in horror games especially, and I think Bloodborne, because there's so much to take in, the second it becomes like a really difficult challenge, you lose that immersion right away because you're not afraid. You're not worried to turn the corner or take the next step. You're upset. You're mad. You're mad at this monster. You're not like in awe of its wonder and how interesting it is. And it's like lore implications. You're saying, I'm going to hit this with an axe until it falls down because I hate it. It's not, you know, and I think a lot of games do that. I think a lot of horror games try to put like difficult puzzles in or like these sections that are like quick time events. And it's like, this is now I'm falling and I'm getting killed and I'm resetting and you just get like a you died on it. And that totally resets my immersion. And so at that point, I think that's when the sanity meter is kind of disabled. So it doesn't really matter what for me, I'm not trying to speak for everyone, but the way that you have this meter and you're like, okay, I need to make sure I'm seeing the world. You want to see the monster. You want to experience everything. But if you do it too much, you'll go crazy. But then if you keep losing and resetting and losing and resetting, now it's just like you're facing the wall running through these passages. You're like, I don't even want to play this anymore. I don't want to play this part anymore. And you lose that immersion. And I think that's like the biggest mistake horror games make. I've played a few in my time. And I find that is like the biggest way to like disarm themselves.
I'll put it to you, Richard, that what you just said is why I think these Lovecraft games work better than other horror games.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say why. So Resident Evil 4 is a very scary game, but if you die a lot, you don't get scared anymore. You know, you just get frustrated. And what you want to see in that game is you want to see the conclusion of the story. So you want to keep going. But with a Lovecraft game like Bloodborne or Amnesia, there's this sense of like, you really fit the bill of a Lovecraftian protagonist because you become so inured to the horror that all you want is to like see the next thing. You're almost angry at the universe because you're like, you're keeping this from me. And I know you are, and I'm going to find it, right? And then when you find it, it gets worse. So I think like I'm totally with you, but I almost feel like it's a recursive thing where it breaks your immersion to bring you back into it. And other horror games don't do that as well.
That is kind of this quintessential experience of you in any From Software game, really, but let's stick with Bloodborne for the sake of simplicity now. You run into a new enemy and you have this kind of sensation of overwhelming dread because this enemy is like, it's incomprehensible in its movements. Its design is frightening. It screams. It's like, it's this overwhelming experience that really can, not only the character, but even you yourself as a player, put you in a situation of like total distress. I remember how many times I've played Bloodborne running into a new boss and my heart was like pounding in my chest just because of the way that boss fight and that boss itself was designed. And then over time, you get more into the motions of a sort of instrumental engagement where you're like, okay, I'm learning the attack pattern. Okay, I'm not doing this again. Roll, and attack, you know, like this kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's definitely, it's a very precise observation that horror games often try and often fail, unfortunately, to produce and reproduce this experience of overwhelming dread at the first sight of the monster.
And just to Bloodborne's credit, even though I just criticized it, the Ludwig fight, that reveal in the Old Hunter DLC is one of my favorite reveals, I think, and like one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen. Like every time I look at it, I still don't know what I'm seeing. And it does eventually become, I want him to die. You know, there is certainly, he's like difficult. He does get to that point. But like, I think if that initial reveal is powerful enough, it sticks with you past any sort of frustration.
I don't want to cut you off, but the reason I think that that DLC is so brilliant is because at the end of it, you defeat the Orphan of Kos, this, you know, child of a great old one, basically like the son of Cthulhu, if you want to put it in Lovecraft terms, and you get no resolution. You have no idea what sure. It is. And it just goes back to what Maria says, which is it should have been left well enough alone. Like, why would you do this? This is, you're left with this pit. Like, oh, why did I do that? I put myself through hell for nothing.
And in some ways, the Old Hunter DLC gives you context to that world, which is what you're craving the entire game. You're looking for that context. You're looking for it all to make sense. And you get scraps of it, but you, at no point do you get the answer. Like kind of what you were saying, you don't, it's not like the payoff. I think you thought like you get a weapon called Ludwig's Holy Blade and then you meet Ludwig. You're like, oh, cool. You meet Maria, which people talk about. I think they mention her in main game, or maybe they don't, but she's important to the story in the way that it goes. But then you also are introduced to other nightmares and terrors and things you can't understand. So it's like, okay, now I have this I have to deal with. Like, that's all squared away. But now I got this.
If you want to enter the DLC in Bloodborne, then you need to let yourself be grabbed by the amygdala, right?
Yeah.
And this emphasizes another aspect that is very crucial to Lovecraftian aesthetics, as well as to their adaptation in video games, which is that generally we're dealing with very vulnerable protagonists. In Bloodborne, it is one of your most vulnerable moments because you're grabbed by the enemy and you have to give up control to basically submit to this kind of overwhelming creature, to this kind of madness. The same thing goes for other games that we've mentioned, such as Amnesia, where you can't fight back. You're a physically fragile character. You're a mentally fragile character because you're so susceptible to everything you see. Imagine you're playing Gears of War and the soldiers are constantly like having a meltdown whenever a new enemy type occurs, right? So there's an emphasis of human vulnerability that is at the bottom of this and that propels these games forward, I feel.
Even in that fast-paced game, what don't you have compared to other From Software games?
A shield. Oh, I thought I was making a joke. I'm sorry.
You're totally right. It is kind of a joke because you go into it and like there's so many times in that game you're like, boy, I wish I could defend myself, and you can't. The only way you can defend yourself is by pressing onward and being aggressive, and that's really like Daniel in Amnesia. The only way that he can proceed is by proceeding. He can't retreat. There's no way for him to do that.
Sure, and I think that's like another thing that keeps you moving because it keeps you moving through Bloodborne, even when it gets difficult and frustrating. It's fun to move in Bloodborne with like the sidesteps as opposed to like the fat rolling and then the moving around in like other From Software games. You get to kind of shuffle and you kind of groove and into this like rhythm. And I think that makes moving fun. And when the moving is fun in your game, the game is good, right? Like, I feel like if your main mechanic is moving and the moving is fun to do, then your game is basically like, everything else is just bonus.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's almost like Bloodborne at its best is almost like a rhythm game.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It really
is. Yeah.
It's a terrifying Guitar Hero that we didn't even know we wanted.
Well, there are also many other, let's say, more indirect or more symbolic adaptations of Lovecraft in video games. For example, Arkham Asylum. I think the term Arkham, if I'm correctly informed, it comes from Lovecraft, right? Because Lovecraft was inspired by a town, I think, called Oakham, if I'm not mistaken, because he found that town particularly beautiful, particularly inspiring. So he made his own, like, fictional Arkham, and that was adopted by DC Comics. And that's where this kind of Arkham Asylum idea emerged. And suddenly, we stand there and have to realize that the subject is way broader than we might have initially thought, because even something like Arkham Asylum, the Batman games, they also tie into this Lovecraftian aesthetics.
There's actually a pretty Lovecraftian character in it. The Warden Sharp, the head of Arkham Asylum, thinks that he's possessed by the spirit of Arkham. And so he's writing these journals and leaving these messages cryptically, very much like the Call of Cthulhu. Here's a message of a journal of a conversation I had. And so even in the indirect references, there's elements of this. I'm telling you a story that I heard secondhand that I believe to be true because of personal reasons.
In my experience, Lovecraft is at its best when it's a love letter to Lovecraft. I think adaptations often fall short, but I think when people are sort of inspired, like Sinking City, for example. Have either of you played the Sinking City?
I know of its existence, but I haven't played it.
It's like an open world 20s detective game, but it's very, it's set in the Lovecraft world. So what you're getting are references to Innsmouth, references to deities, and sort of like these races, like the Throgmortons are in there. I believe they're in, they're an ape looking type of creature in Lovecraft. And it feels like it doesn't get the point. And I'm not a critic. I'm not like trying to give this game a bad review. It's thundering here. I'm sorry if you heard that.
Ah, it's beautiful. Some thunder.
Richard, cut that out.
Beautiful, perfect setting for the conversation.
Oh, that, ooh. It's a fourth guest has entered the chat. I feel like it doesn't understand. It doesn't give me what I want, which is the madness and like the complex dynamics of these situations. It just kind of gives me a machine gun and says, go get them.
What you're hitting on is something that I've struggled with Lovecraft adaptations a lot, which is, they definitely understand the aesthetics of Lovecraft, but they don't understand the ideas, you know, or they're not interested in exploring the ideas or the philosophy that Lovecraft had. And I think that one kind of precludes the other, because if you're looking at a story that just wants to focus on, you know, being obsessed with knowledge or the fear of the outsider or, you know, the fear of the unknown, often Lovecraftian imagery will pop up after you're looking into that kind of stuff, because it just goes hand in hand. But if you go with the imagery first, it doesn't always mesh, I think.
Well, if we're talking about H.P. Lovecraft references, I think Elden Ring does it best, in my opinion, because...
Oh, interesting.
Sure, we see Mr. Octopus and all of his friends in other H.P. Lovecraft like inspired games and these sorts of things. But like the hidden cities in Elden Ring, the fact that you like go down these elevators and you find like a big temple and it's like these hidden ruins and these cities that are totally lost to time. That is the Lovecraft element that I love. That is like my bread and butter in that capacity, like the Nameless City, the temple, and there are more. I'm just kind of touching on it. At the Mountains of Madness has that as well, where they're exploring these old cities. And I think that is just, it's so overwhelming. And he always says cyclopean, which is such a great word. It's just like ancient, colossal architecture, and the way that tells that story. That's what I like about it. And I thought Elden Ring did that better than any game I'd ever played.
I remember, Stefan, when you were playing Elden Ring and you were kind of telling me your journey through the Lands Between.
Yes.
At one point you just said, hey, did you know there's an entire other map? With the kind of weariness of a Lovecraftian protagonist.
Yeah, the exertion when you realize that this game has just begun.
Yes.
Inconspicuous elevator. And then you go down there and it's like as if you're exploring Relia, you know?
Yes.
Which is the city of Cthulhu, of course. The interesting part about this Elden Ring illusion is just exactly that. It's Elden Ring, it's not Cthulhu the game or Lovecraft the game. Maybe Lovecraft is, in a sense, it's almost like a toolkit. It's like an assemblage of various different aspects that can make a game really interesting and infuse it with such aspects like the encounters with madness, the vulnerability of protagonists, the intricacy through which we acquire knowledge and the overwhelming sensation of having done so, and put that all into the context of a video game. It does not need a Cthulhu license to be a good Lovecraft game.
I completely agree. And I don't know if you ever look on Steam and look under the Lovecraft like tag. I do that every so often just because sometimes you see things that aren't really on your radar and people will just put like a tentacle in it. And it's like, hey, look at this one. It's like, well, that's not quite what I'm looking for. But then you find great stuff like there's an indie game called The Shore. That is, it's kind of like a walking simulator.
Mm.
A little bit, but it's kind of like Lighthouse. It's very like that. So you're on an island. So the isolation, you're dealing with madness. You're seeing things you don't understand. And the fact that it does have some of those Cthulhu monsters, the fact that it does have those is kind of a footnote. It's because you do have like the madness. You do have these things you don't understand. You're kind of working through these situations. And then at the end, you're like, oh, I know this guy. You know, like this is my old buddy. And that just sort of like seals it. Other than that, I was like, this is just like a good psychological horror game. And then you see familiar shapes and you say, oh, this is like an actual Lovecraft experience. And that's just not what I knew I was signing up for in the best way, of course.
I mean, this is why cosmic horror is a genre, right? I think it's because of Lovecraft, really. He hit on these themes. And if you start telling stories in that genre, then you can't help but call back to the Cthulhu man himself. And I think it's just virtue of right time, right place. And let's be frank, like a very xenophobic gentleman from the 1900s.
We can't forget that.
We can't. Well, I think it informs a lot of what he talked about, which was, sure. There's a great joke that all of the fish people in The Shadow over Innsmouth are just like Italians to H.P. Lovecraft. This idea that he was just writing about, you know, he's not a great guy, but he has some great work is our point.
Sure. Death of the author, I believe, is the phrase.
If you could make a Lovecraft game, what would that be?
Hmm.
I think I would make a Lovecraft game in the 1980s and I would call it Stranger Things.
I think you might be onto something there.
That's going to catch on. That's going to catch on like wildfire.
Yeah. A whole lot of money, that.
I think if I made one, Sonic the Hedgehog would be there. I'm not sure what that else. I'm not sure what that would look like, but it would be Sonic, and H.P. Lovecraft would be there. And I'm not sure.
You know, I think it would probably look like, you know, you mentioned, Richard, the Sinking City, where it's just this kind of collection of things that you recognize. And I wonder if I wouldn't be able to divorce a game from those things. So I think if I made a game, it would probably take place in the early 1900s. It would be about a kind of a hard-boiled detective who gets in over his head and learns things that he shouldn't learn. I think that's, to me, this kind of noirish, the noir is kind of the in to the real cosmic horror that you come into later, visiting this town that shouldn't exist with people who are older and stranger than they should be, and doing all you can to make things make sense and failing miserably at it.
Sure. And if you can introduce the mechanic and why you'd be seeking that knowledge, like a scholar or an investigator or something like that, I feel like that's half the work, is you've already set up these elements and these driving forces that everything else just kind of comes naturally to.
Well, thank you so very much, Richard, for coming by.
It's been my pleasure.
To all of you out there, if you have an idea of what a wonderful Lovecraft game would look like, then please reach out to us. You can always do so by going to studyingpixels.com/contact. If you want to support us, then you can do so by joining Studying Pixels Plus at studyingpixels.com/plus. If you want to follow us, then you can find us on your favorite podcasting app, Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, and YouTube. Thank you again, Richard, and we'll talk again next week. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.